listening to Kent Biz Connect, the show that connects businesses in Kent to do business. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome once again to the bi-weekly Kent Biz Connect radio show with myself, Martin White, and my co-host.
And me, Brian Wakefield.
Brian, welcome back to the studio after your sabbatical recently.
Yes, I missed the last show, didn't I?
How was the weather in Cyprus?
Oh, it was dreadful. 28 degrees of sunshine, not a drop of rain.
Oh.
Shorts and flip-flops the whole time.
It's a hard life, isn't it?
Sea, sun, sand, yeah. No sangria, yeah. but lots of other things. Yeah, I know, it just has to be done.
And you were celebrating a big birthday. Vicky, who's one of our guests, we'll introduce you in a second, Vicky, but we must just get this out of the way. She asked you if you turned 40, I think, didn't she?
I think she's probably referring to my waist measurement at that particular time.
I was going to say, if we add a zero onto that, we might be getting
she said 50 was passable. And I thought, that will do for me. She's now got a friend for life.
Anyway, it's great to have you back. Welcome back into studio. We've got two fabulous guests with us, as always, today. To my right, we have...
Oh, Paul Turner from the Marlowe Theatre.
Sorry, Paul.
Caught him by surprise a bit.
I was just asleep.
Didn't tell you I was going to do that, did I?
Bit like you in the news earlier. And to my left...
And Paul's right.
Yeah. I'm Vicky Mansell from SNS Solicitors and Mediate Kent.
Vicky, welcome to the studio. Welcome to the studio, both of you. We're going to kick off with some what we hope is sort of topical Kent business news to start the show, and then we'll talk to you both individually. But by all means, feel free to join in at any point. I know we're going to be talking about Canterbury and other things as well that are in the news. If you want to tweet us, you can do. It's at Kent_biz. If you have any burning questions for our guests in the studio, then please, by all means, tweet them in. But Brian, kick us off. What's happening out there? What's going on?
Yeah, with my usual fortnightly scour through the news to see what's happening. And a couple of things did indeed catch my eye this morning. So we've got our friends at Uber. Oh. So they're in the news a little bit. And do we know why, I hear you ask?
You're gonna enlighten us.
Yeah, I will, actually. Well, TfL, Transport for London, have actually in the process of revoking their licence to operate. How does that affect us, we think? But Dartford and Medway were operating areas under the London. So very, very shortly, you won't be able to get an Uber in Dartford or Medway. And I suspect that those areas will increase.
Will that include Bromley, do you think, and Bexley? Because they're all London boroughs, aren't
they?
Well,
I think it probably will. Yeah, it's still, yeah, London borough of Bromley and Bexley, but they say Bromley-Kent, so it's a bit weird.
So the old establishment of the black cabbies in London has won out, by the
sounds
of it.
Well, they have, and yeah, they're on the streets celebrating as we speak, I'm led to believe.
You can't get a taxi at the moment.
And they're probably not, no, they're all partying, aren't they? Yeah, that's the thing. And it's interesting, because obviously there has been an ongoing protest by normal taxi drivers against being undercut and stuff. But the official line is that it's around safety and security. Mm. I don't know the full details because I've never been an Uber driver. But my understanding of it is that if you book an Uber and it goes onto a particular app, any other self-employed Uber driver can then get access to somebody's information. So in theory, you know, you could be booked to do an 8 o'clock pickup. I could kind of not hack in, I could just go onto your bit and see that you had an 8 o'clock pickup, get there at 5:02, basically nick your fare, which is one thing. But I think the other that has sort of far wider reaching implications is that it's not then traceable, because, you know, you'll just say, well, I didn't do the fare, and they're never going to find me. So, you know, I could kind of, you know, mug them and do all kinds of things basically with no comeback. So
I've got to say, I always in London, I always like the fact that the cabbies had done the knowledge, as it's called, and they, you know, in order to pass the knowledge, they need to know every single street like the back of their hand, don't they? And you know, that always impressed me, actually, about, you know, in fact I in a funny way, I used to kind of aspire to getting in a black cab in London, you know,
because you made it when you get into a
that's right,
apart from the fact you needed the money to you know, to get in one. But so, you know, but it's interesting, isn't it, because there's so much change going on at the moment in, you know, in terms of new businesses coming into very established kind of marketplaces and disrupting them and having new kind of models. And we talked about kind of Deliveroo and, you know, Just Eat and all these kinds of people. But it doesn't always work, does it, clearly? You know, it's not enough to say to someone, I can do something differently and I can do it, you know, cheaper. You know, clearly in this instance, they've fallen foul of the regulator on kind of security and safety reasons.
Yeah, I think so. In that instance, it's like a lot of others. If you're going to undercut the going rate by lots of money, many would suggest you're cutting a few corners. And one of the corners that they would be cutting is that training. I suspect not many of them have done that knowledge thing that takes years, by the way. So, yeah, they're not trained to that kind of standard. And I don't know what the vetting process is like on them. They don't have to sit all these exams and stuff like that, I assume.
Well, it's classic gig economy stuff, isn't it? You know, you've got a private car. You know, you can just log into an app as an Uber.
Yeah, 4 hours in the evening, I'll go and earn some money.
Go and do a bit of cabbing, you know. You don't need to be anybody other than someone that's got a vehicle that you can use for that purpose, I guess.
But it is using the same software as what they use for these delivery companies, isn't it? And that was even on Watchdog recently on the TV, wasn't it, about how even they're not vetted to deliver your food. You may ask, why do they need to be vetted? But actually, you know, they're dangerous as well, just being on push bikes everywhere. So there's a whole issue around that. That new market.
Well, anybody that's knocking on your front door late at night.
Absolutely. Knows your name, knows your address, knows what you like to eat, you know.
What's your sort of take on it, Vicky, from a, I don't know, a legal standpoint?
Well, I don't know
about
a legal point necessarily, but I think it's like with everything, you get what you pay for. And, you know, people quite often say to me, well, why would I come to a solicitor, for example, for this, which I can download off the internet or whatever? And I'm like, well, would you go to a zookeeper to sell your house? No, you wouldn't. You'd go to someone who's specialist and qualified and knows what they're doing. Yeah. Same with the taxi drivers, you know, you pay peanuts and you get monkeys.
Would you get in a car with someone that you...
Absolutely not.
You know, you wouldn't necessarily expect to know them, but you might expect them to have some kind of certification or
accreditation. I mean, I grew up in London, and when I was a teenager, it was very much, you know, if you're going out in town, you don't just jump in a taxi. It's really easy to do, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. Not that I was out at 3 o'clock in the morning, obviously. But if I was out at that hour, it was, you know,
hypothetically.
You order a taxi from wherever establishment you're leaving and then you go by name because it's just basic safety. And this is 20 years ago now, and it seems that this is like this safety element is still not part of people's everyday thinking, and it's slightly scary.
It's one of those things, isn't it, when there's a new thing in the industry, is how quickly governments actually respond to this and actually start to legislate it properly. And that's what's been slow, isn't it? They've been able to run this long without any real challenge.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly that.
They've still got their license because they're trading.
Well, they don't know how to deal with it.
Well, they're trading under appeal at the moment, I believe. So, you know, until the appeal judgment is kind of heard and kind of ruled on, then they are still allowed to trade. But the same thing happened in New York, didn't it, with the yellow cab drivers. They were similarly up in arms when Uber kind of came into the marketplace.
So, oh yeah, big time.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you know, you've got two schools of thought, I guess. One is kind of consumer choice, and you know, that's nobody wants to kind of put you know, constraints on consumer choice necessarily. But at the same time, you know, there does need to be regulation, and one size doesn't fit all sort of thing. So it's interesting. This might be the first of many. So watch this space.
It could be a trendsetter, couldn't it?
Yeah.
But I can't remember when Uber started now. I don't know. How long would they have been going in London? 5 years, 8 years, I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
It must be.
So as you said, Paul, it's quite a long time, isn't it, really, for them to not get away with it, but for it to be unlicensed.
Well, they've had this hanging over their heads, haven't they, for some time. So I think it's clearly sort of, you know, not before time that they kind of said one way or the other what they can and can't do. So interesting.
So if there's an issue there around software systems and stuff like that, there's another systems issue in the news as well, actually. So TSB, and I never know whether they're part of Lloyd's, Halifax, or who they belong to these
were
days,
they the bank that liked to say yes?
Yeah, years ago.
Originally.
Yeah. They did.
They liked to say yes, but they never actually can, but they'd like to.
We aspire to say, the bank that aspires to say yes, but rarely does.
Yeah, computer says no. Was it Trustee Savings Bank or something initially? Was that what TSB stood for? So
well, it was Lloyd's TSB, wasn't it? And then I think they got, I think they were sold off as part of the Lloyd's.
I think it was standalone TSB.
Oh, before that.
Before
oh, yeah.
Lloyd
I'm sure.
did the thing.
I'm sure.
Yeah, mm. yeah. But anyway, they are to close 82 branches next year.
Mm.
So that's quite a lot. That's I think that's about 15 or 17% of their branches, because they've got 500 and something. And they're going to be going to 400.
So is that yet another nail in the high street coffin? Do we think?
Well, it's interesting because the quote from them is that yes, we're closing 82 branches. However, we're about to invest £120 million in digital solutions. So. Solutions yeah. to digital problems yeah. that they don't have now, presumably, and products and services. I don't know what else you would invest in, but yes, this 120 million quid in products, services, yeah. and digital solutions.
Yeah.
I think it's going to internet banking yeah. easier. It's another step, surely, to the yeah. push.
Let me give you my take on banking digital solutions. So I do have a high street branch of Barclays that I have to use occasionally, because, you know, we all have physical stuff that needs to be paid in sometimes, like, you know, cheques or...
Cheques.
Well,
I don't.
But if your aunt writes you a cheque for your birthday or something, you have no choice but to pop into a branch and pay it in.
You do now. On your app, you can now pay a cheque in up to £500.
Right. I didn't even know that.
What do you do with the cheque?
Mm. You keep it for 2 days, and once it's cleared, you dispose of it safely, and that's
it. Really?
Yeah. Lloyd's do that.
How interesting. Well, it's not something that my bank of...
We'll get your auntie to do a back transfer on the phone.
I will next time, yeah. But anyway, so I walked into my local branch to pay some money in a couple of weeks ago. And of course, we don't have any physical people inside the branch now. We still have a physical branch, but we only have one counter.
Oh.
And we have a machine that, of course, will do everything for you. But unfortunately, it didn't like one of the £10 notes that I had to pay in, and it kept spitting it out. No matter how many times I tried to fold it back and, you know, make it kind of flat and smooth.
Flip it upside down.
All of that. And so it spat it out about 3 times, which I think had taken me sort of 10 minutes at that point to kind of to get to the point where I then had to queue up, you know, to manually kind of pay that money in. And, you know, it just... you couldn't write it. It was just laughable.
Yeah,
so,
no.
But TSB are one of those banks that kind of makes the headlines for all the wrong reasons all the time, aren't they? With customers not being able to access their bank accounts and payments. I think it was last weekend or something. They hit the news again, or one of the banks did. And you can imagine the upheaval that would cause someone, wouldn't you? If their salary couldn't go in, or if their mortgage payment couldn't go out, you know, because the bank wasn't operating.
Mm.
You imagine the kind of the fees that you would incur, you know, through late payments and stuff like that. I mean, where does it all end?
Which they would surely refund. However, it's the inconvenience and the time, isn't it, to make that happen.
Yeah. But if you had a branch, presumably you could walk into a branch and say, look, guys. And I think they were trying to prioritise people that had a genuine need, you know, along those lines, because their mortgage payment was coming out or whatever it was. But if you haven't got a branch to go into to kind of have a conversation with someone, how does that work in practice? You know, you have to sit on an endless kind of phone queue waiting for someone to answer your question, I guess. I don't know.
You queue up to talk to your personal relationship manager that's based in Delhi.
Yeah.
Well, personal relationship.
Outsourced again. Yeah.
I think the problem is as well with digital banking, digital anything, is that, you know, a lot of my clients are older, should we say, and they can't do it.
No.
They don't know, they cannot, even sitting on a phone to your personal advisor is tricky for them. And actually they need to be able to go into a bank and look at someone in the face and say, this is what my statement says. What does it mean?
Let alone trying to book a flight on Ryanair.
Well,
as if anybody would do that.
And understand what you've paid for or what you haven't paid for and what you should be paying for. I mean, it's just a minefield, isn't it? You're absolutely right. How do vulnerable people in the community, whether they be old or disabled, how do they actually navigate through, you know, those kind of systems today? It's a nightmare.
There's another radio show, not as good as this one, on Radio 4 called Moneybox, which is on every Saturday. And I don't know if you've ever listened to that. But they were actually talking on Saturday about the banking, what happens last weekend. And basically, it's these old established banks that have not got the infrastructure right. So the volumes of traffic they're now doing digitally, they're not ready for it. And they can't catch back up. Whereas the new people in the market, the Metro banks is just an example, are just digital, really. They they still do that high street bike and actually do that better than most, actually, Metro. They're one of them ones that really are open 7 days a week and quite late at night, and you can get your bank card done. I don't use these, by the way. I just know this is what they do.
You've got a big one in Canterbury.
We have got a big one in Canterbury, and I don't use them, but this new model that they've got, but actually the digital stuff, they've got absolutely spot on.
Yes.
And these old established banks, like the TSBs, haven't invested enough. So that's their decline, is what they keep getting wrong. And people are leaving now in their droves, aren't they?
Gosh. And they've been making money hand over fist for all this time. I mean, you look at Lloyds, I don't know what their kind of the running total of their PPI compensation is. I would have to ask Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnie, do you know? say goodbye to the PPI. he'll know. Arnie, ring in and let us know.
I'll be back.
But it's in the billions. I mean, it's probably, I don't know, 20 billion now, Lloyds' liability on that front alone. You think, surely you could have invested some of that money in infrastructure over the years. You know, it's just bonkers, isn't it?
I'd love to know what PPI cost the country in all the industries. Mm. How much was paid out?
Mm.
Doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
Shocking number, isn't it? But so you're absolutely right. So they just haven't kept pace with what's happened. You know, how it's all evolved, I guess. So yeah,
I can't remember the last time I went into a bank branch. I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, perhaps. Maybe to get some pound coins or something, but it was something fairly easy. But don't take checks anymore. Do everything online. It's just a real pain.
Paul, we spoke about Canterbury briefly. I know you're very involved at the Marlow with an initiative called Canterbury Bid. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that in the context of the high street and what you guys are doing in Canterbury to actually invest in the high street?
Sure. So Canterbury has a Canterbury Bid, which is a community investment company where basically the business ratepayers of Canterbury pay an additional levy, which obviously in this climate is difficult for them to do as well, but it's voted in by a ballot system. So the businesses in the high street and inside the city walls have all agreed to put this additional money into the city centre a year, around about £500,000. Mm-hmm. Per annum that we put into that, and the Marlow's one of them organisations that pay that money, and basically that's about investing back into the centre of Canterbury to make Canterbury a place where people want to go to, and that's really focusing on the businesses. So, you know, these small independents to these large chains, Canterbury needs to look beautiful, have great Christmas lights, great summer flowers, and have
eateries,
and actually making it clean and tidy so that when you walk in, you know, it's a nice place to be and a safe place. So we have also ambassadors that walk around the high street and tell people where to go, because there's such a, you know, tourist community there as well, to help them people in Canterbury, because it's not very well signposted.
That's
inside
a nice
Canterbury
idea, isn't it? So like the people you have in the cathedral who are information kind of people.
Yes, we have them in the city centre as well doing that. And also about helping businesses develop. So the large areas of like Primark and Marks and Spencers, they might have the corporate backing to train their staff and do digital and media training and stuff like that, but the small independents don't. So we provide training for them companies as well, and it's all free, part of being a levy payer. They can come along and join in and learn, you know, what is this social media lark that's going on? How do I get part of it? So we've got some training in the new year, which I'll share with you, so that the Canterbury businesses can pop in and have a look to
how
see
do
what's
we
going.
Take online payments.
Exactly. So all that type of stuff is brilliant. And I'm a volunteer, so I sit on the subcommittee. I chair the subcommittee, so I probably do about 100 hours a year working with the team. And we do that for the Marlow. We're involved in it because of not only being a levy payer, but actually we want Canterbury to just be brilliant. And with the central government funding cuts and the local authority can't do everything anymore, what do? Just sit back and let it stop? No, of course we don't. We make Canterbury brilliant so that, you know, people come and, you know, there's jobs there, and because that impacts on us all.
So how long has that initiative been running now then?
So we've just had a re-election, basically a new ballot, which has meant it's just been gone through for a second phase. So 5 years has happened, and we've now got our next 5-year business plan online now, which we're now there to deliver. And my role of that is, it's effectively like being a governor. I'm a director effectively, but I'm there to govern to make sure that money is spent and what we promised we would spend it on and deliver it. So, you know, one of the big initiatives that was in that was actually Wi-Fi in Canterbury. Canterbury in the High Street because the phone signal's horrendous. Of course, we're lobbying to get better phone signal.
Is that because there aren't any masts in Canterbury or around?
Well, it must be because there's no signal.
Is there? I mean, you know, every time you go there, you think, I still can't believe I can't get a mobile phone signal.
It is amazing, the signal in Canterbury. But Wi-Fi is a solution for that. So, you know, at the theatre, we've got a Wi-Fi network which has probably 1,000 hits every Saturday when the audience are in it on you know, two show days. So we know Wi-Fi is important for this modern day. Yeah. So we're looking at doing that with the city council and rolling that out across the whole of the city centre, which will be amazing.
So this is private sector businesses that have got together and said, look, you know, we're lacking in some fundamental areas that are going to help the high street prosper. What are we going to do about it? If we sit back and wait for the state to provide, it's never going to happen. So we need
There's always
got to
be
ourselves.
A seed at the start and, and, you know, somebody's got to say, this is what we should be doing. And then it's about getting support to do that. And thankfully, the businesses in Canterbury, close to 60% of them said, yes, this is what we need to do. Now, I know that's not always the most popular because these small independent traders are finding it tough. But our job is also to make sure that if they are a small levy payer, that they're getting value out of it and get them into them training courses and get them networking so they can grow their business. That's really important.
Yeah. So you had quite a clear-cut decision there in terms of support for...
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
So you didn't need a second referendum.
No, it was decided. Oh, okay.
Obviously, a lot more clear cut than the one we've just been. Well, that's brilliant. That sounds absolutely fabulous, Brian. There's some other areas that you know that kind of do a similar thing as well. I think you were saying.
There was. I know there's one up in Bromley.
Yeah.
And in the town where we live in the mighty Maidstone.
Right. Right, okay.
I have met some people involved in it, but you don't see too much on it, I have to say.
So, I really like it because, I mean, you know, down where I live, you know, down in Thanet, and, you know, we really struggle for those kind of basic things around Christmas. I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. A friend of mine, he's left now, but he used to work at the council. He was the tree officer for Thanet District Council.
Oh,
and he was in the council offices one day, and one of the sort of rare instances where he actually had to turn up for work. And I think one of his bosses asked him if he could go to a local park and cut down a fir tree, you know, a Douglas fir or whatever it was, you know, a Christmas tree, in other words, because they didn't have any. And they didn't have a budget for a Christmas tree. So can you go to the park and cut one down?
Did he work in the main office or was it a branch office?
Very good.
What Brian said, though, is really important there about not many people know about these things. And actually, that's something we've talked about as our bid in Canterbury is actually, I think people still think the city council put up their Christmas lights every year, but it's not. It's the Canterbury bid. I think people think it's still that old school style of local authority.
Oh, it absolutely is, isn't it? At the very least, somebody will sponsor it and pay for it, or it's the bid, isn't
but
it?
When you've got a city the size of Canterbury, I mean, Christmas lights in that is not cheap. You know, you're talking in the region of £60,000 to put them up for a 5-6 week period in Canterbury. You know,
Is that to buy the lights new? Or is that
I mean, this is all in all our accounts are published online. So it's like
who pays the Leckie bill?
Yeah. So it's like 5 years. We would buy them for 5 years. We do a tender process for that one. So it's 5 years with some changes to tweak them each year to make them look fresh. But it's a 5-year contract that you go into to do that. So that's what the businesses of Canterbury are committed to there by doing this, bringing it in. That's 5 years. That's what they've got. But we, you're right. We don't talk about it, and we don't take enough credit. No. For what that group does. And yes, there's a paid team that do it, but there's volunteers. So, I mean, this next cycle, we will really be talking about what it is that we're doing as well.
Well, Ramsgate is known for its harbour illuminations at Christmas, but it's nothing to do with the council. These are all private boat owners that decorate their boats with Christmas lights, you know, and that's what it's become known for.
Yeah.
You know, go and see the lights down at the harbour at Ramsgate. It's nothing to do with, you know, with
like
the council.
Northern Lights, now all the boat owners trying to outdo each other by having a bigger, brighter display.
So I'm all for it. And in fact, do you know what? The more kind of control we can take over things like that, as individuals, as businesses, the better, ultimately, because, you know, we only need to look at what's going on now and the kind of the stalemate that we've got in the wheels of government up at Westminster. I mean, the more the more control we can take over local matters on that level, I think the better. So well done.
I'll tell you, you'll probably know is Peter Sell, who, funny enough, we mentioned Metrobank earlier, but he's hosting an FSB Metrobank networking event on Wednesday, probably 6 till 8 or something like that. And I bet he'll know what's going on with the bid stuff and what the latest is.
Well, I don't know why you got that in, but now that you have, I'll have to tell everybody out there that there's also one here.
Is
at
there?
The fabulous Kent Space on Wednesday
on
evening.
Wednesday?
Our hosts at Kent Space in Ashford at the Electroset building are also having a networking this Wednesday evening with Nibbles included as well.
Oh, so, Nibbles as well.
So you've got one
we
in
get,
Ashford.
We get Nibbles at Metrobank, you know.
And you've got one in Maidstone. But anyway, we need to move on. We're going to play a bit of music now by way of an introduction to our first guest. And
is there a link?
There will be a link.
Do we need to guess the link?
We need to guess the
Good.
Link.
Good. Love
so
that bit.
That's exactly what we're going to do after this.
You're listening to Kent Biz Connect. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Welcome back, Brian. Do tell, who were we listening to?
Oh, we listened to Joe Strummer and the boys there. That was the Mighty Clash.
The Mighty Clash, and that was a live version, by the way.
Yeah, it was. One of many that was recorded. So,
Of the song was?
Oh, that was I Fought the Law.
I Fought the Law. And I guess if you're going to fight the law, you need somebody in your corner to help you fight the law.
Well, Martin, I don't know if I would say that I fight the law.
Yeah,
the law
wouldn't win if they was fighting Vicky, let me tell you.
Vicky, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This is your first time on Kent Biz Connect.
It's my first time on any radio station, Martin.
Any radio station? Oh. Well, you're remarkably calm considering. we'll try not to throw you too much.
I've injected her twice with stuff to calm her down a bit.
But you are a partner at SNS Law based in Maidstone.
Yep.
And you've just set up a new initiative as well called Mediate Kent.
Yep, that's right. So we're obviously a law firm in Mason, and we've been going for about 5 years now. And we've just set up, like you say, a company called Mediate Kent, which is designed to bring mediation to businesses and local people.
Right. So let's start with a kind of a definition of what mediation is, because I guess most people think of the law as, I don't know, you're going to end up in court at some point throwing mud at each other, and then somebody's going to decide who wins and who gets to pay the bill. But mediation is slightly different, I guess, is it?
Yeah, so mediation is not, it's not a legal requirement for things like that. It's sometimes people think about it as, it might look a bit sort of flowery. You know, everyone sits down in a room and sort of has a chat about how they feel and they sort it out. In fact, mediation is a very important stage in the legal process. So in law, before you go to court, lots and lots of cases now are required to mediate before they actually turn up in court. And if you turn up in court and the judge says, have you mediated? And you say no, the judge will send you outside. And it's basically you have both sides get in a room together and there's a mediator, so someone there to almost, I guess, referee. Mm. So both sides can put their point across, say they can consider what it's cost, what it's going to cost, whether they're going to win, whether they can be bothered. I mean, going to court is a massive financial and emotional undertaking. You know, never go to court if you can possibly avoid it. Mm. I don't work in court because I just think the whole process is really, you can't be sure about what's going to happen. And people spend tens of thousands of pounds and they lose all sorts of things in the process. Mm. And the point about mediation is you spend half a day or a day in a room or in, you know, two different rooms, and the mediator shuttles between them both. And they, both sides can sort of understand where the other side is coming from. And both sides can say, look, if we can come up with a solution that both people are sort of happy to walk away from, we can agree that today and we can both say it's done, draw a line under it and walk away feeling like they've both sort of left with something, as opposed to someone leaving from court with nothing and someone else leaving from court like they've won everything.
Now, that all sounds, as you said, lovely in an ideal
nice
world.
Nice and cuddly, yeah.
Yes. But are you a mediator?
Yes.
That's right. So presumably there's a formal qualification or accreditation that you have to go through.
Yeah, so John, Gareth and I are all qualified mediators.
Right.
We can mediate anything. Mm-hmm. I'm specially qualified in SEND matters, which is special educational needs and disability.
Right.
So what I'm going to be doing is mediating between, for example, a care home and a resident. So if the family are unhappy with the care that the care home is providing for their elderly, vulnerable parent, whatever it is, they can hire me for a mediation. I can go in and say, care home, this is what the problem is. Mm-hmm. This is what the family want. How can we meet in the middle and fix it?
Right.
John and Gareth are civil and commercial mediators mainly. So they will mediate on things like contentious probate, when people are arguing about who gets what in the will. So, you know, the classic stepmother versus the son or whatever it is. And it's really successful. And it does, you know, we've all been on training courses. And actually it was quite eye-opening about how we as lawyers look at the world and then how you look at it through the eyes of a mediator. Mm. And we're all really passionate about providing that in a sort of cost-effective way for people in Maidstone and Kent. Mm. Because, you know, London is a centre for everything. You know, any major business happens in London, but you pay for the price. And actually we're collaborating with lots of law firms in Maidstone and the wider area in Kent to provide cost-effective and really good mediations for people who don't have to trek up to London and spend thousands and thousands of pounds on a mediation. They can spend, you know, up to £1,000, maybe £2,000, and the case is done and dusted and it's over.
Do you think it's become so prevalent and so necessary because the law has become perhaps a little bit vague around the edges over time? I mean, you talk about probate, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, I was watching Clint Eastwood at the weekend, Gran Torino, a film I've never seen before.
I'm afraid he is not a lawyer.
No, he's not a real one, is he, Vicky?
But I'll try and make it relevant. Apart from the fact it was a great film, at the end he leaves his Gran Torino to the young kid whose family have been bullied in the neighbourhood. And his family are sitting around and they're all aghast because, you know, they've been cut out of the will. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I naively assumed that if you write a will and these are my kind of final wishes, that actually, you know, who's got the right to then contest that? But that isn't the case necessarily, is it?
It is not the case, no. I mean, there's various sort of hoops that you have to jump through to prove that you can make a claim on an estate after someone's passed away if you've been left out of the will or you're not getting exactly what you think you're going to get. But no, you're quite right. The, you know, my final will and testament is, in fact, not always my final will and testament. And it's the culture that we're living in. It's, you know, litigation culture where everyone feels they're entitled to a bite of the apple. And I mean, the law itself, you know, the courts are sort of struggling to keep up with the amount of litigation that's going through the courts. sometimes you see cases where you think, I don't know how that got to the High Court, whatever it is, but it has, because the legal sort of mechanism has taken it there. And mediation is, it's a massive thing. It's growing all the time. And, you know, we recognise it. S&S solicitors recognise it as a really, really useful tool that we want to promote and get our clients and our colleagues to sort of utilise more.
And that leads me on to my next question, because you've set it up very much as a sort of collaborative thing in the first instance, haven't you? It's not just S&S Law in Maidstone.
No.
You're working with other firms. So how does that work? I mean, how does that come about?
It was an interesting experience because, I mean, you know, lawyers classically like to play by themselves. And we actually threw a dinner party a few months ago, and we invited all the top firms in Maidstone in the local area to get everybody in a room together, just have a conversation. So this is what our idea is. How do you feel about working together? You know, if you've got a space that we can use, or you've got mediation and you can come and use our rooms and things. And it was really, really successful. And the feedback we got from it was really good. And a lot of people, a lot of firms have been really, really supportive of this idea so far. And I'm quite proud to sort of got a conversation going between some of the litigators in Maidstone, who normally would only ever, you know, converse over a snotty letter or a grumpy email or something. Yeah. So it's quite nice. And I think all of us, you know, there's enough work to go around.
Yes.
You know, we're all hopefully working for the same goal, which is the best outcome for our clients. Mm. So, you know, you're stronger together. That's my kind of, you know, view on the world, really. Mm. In general, you know, it doesn't matter about who's doing it as long as someone's doing it.
Mm. Mm. Can I ask a question here on... For the solicitors, is it normal to have mediation services inside a firm? Because it sounds like you're actually going against what you're there aren't you stopping yourself earning more money?
Well, yes, absolutely. But the, you know, the solicitor's code of conduct is you do the best for your client. And if that means saying, I can get you a deal where, you know, your solicitor's fees are going to be $5,000 instead of $35,000, you do the $5,000.
So it's like an ethical stance.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, people, you know, solicitors have always got a bit of a bad rap over the last sort of 20 odd years, because some solicitors, as in any you know, area of business, have not been very good about what they've been doing. But, you know, S&S and a lot of the firms that I know are really trying to do the best for our clients. That's where we come from. You know, we uphold the law and we do the best for our clients. So, yes, it does sound slightly counterintuitive. Mm. But then saying that, if you have a client coming in, you can get it sorted for them, they will recommend you and they will come back.
Yep.
You know, you can have one client and charge them $50,000, and yeah, you've earned $50,000, but they'll never come back. So they'll say, God, you know, they've emptied my bank account. They won't refer you because you're expensive.
Are you finding that people come to you requesting mediation now as opposed to litigation? Is it becoming a sort of a common term and an understood kind
it's
of alternative?
It's cheaper and less stressful, sure.
Is there an awareness in the marketplace?
It's becoming better, but it's not out there yet. Mm. And that's what the Mediate Kent's really about. You know, we are mediators and we can provide mediation, but it's also about educating our community about the alternative dispute resolution, how they can resolve things. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a legal question. It can be, you know, I mean, sometimes parents will mediate with their horrible 15-year-old daughter because the daughter feels like she's not being listened to. So she gets an hour with a mediator and she can say, my mum and dad are so awful to me. And then mum and dad can say, but look, we spend all this money on you and we've taken you to a lovely school. And then the both parties go, oh, actually, yeah, it's not too bad.
Yeah.
And they walk away happy.
Right. And so relationships.
Neighbour disputes. Mm. You know, people arguing about where you put the wheelie bins and the driveway and things. And families, you know, I mean, families is a different type of mediation. So you have to mediate with a family a divorce settlement. You have to try it. But in places where people are already divorced and they're trying to work out what's best for the children or, I don't know, who has them for next Christmas. Mm. And that's mediation fodder.
So it sounds to me like something that you can sort of readily dip in and out of according to your individual circumstances. Yeah. You know, I've just had a row with the neighbour. I think we should have some mediation. Or can you kind of just dip in and out and pay by the hour? Is that how it works?
That's exactly it. Right. That's exactly it. You phone up and say, I've got this dispute.
Yeah.
I mean, or either your lawyer or solicitor will phone up and say, I've got this dispute. It needs to be mediated. Can we sort it? And we say yes. Or someone who's got it's about being the bigger person, I suppose. It's about saying, you know, I'm not afraid to say to my horrible neighbour, I'm fed up of arguing with you.
Yeah.
Can we go for half a day and just talk about this in a room with a
sensible
person?
What if they don't want to come?
Well,
what happens then?
Then you can't really mediate with yourself.
No, that's right. It's a bit pointless.
Well, I'm sure some people do.
But I think it's about... I think it's about people understanding what mediation is. And actually, you know, if you were to contact a mediator and say, I want this service, the mediator will then contact the neighbour, for example, and say, this is an offer that's been made. Mm. Do you want to come? And we can sort this out. This is how it works.
Yeah.
And if the neighbour is a relatively sensible, intelligent person, they may want to say, actually, yeah, do you know what? Mm. I'm fed up of arguing for the last 20 years. I'd like to be able to walk out of my house without feeling I've got to hide from my neighbour. And it's well worth doing.
Gosh, it seems to make an awful lot of sense. Yeah.
It does, but it's just getting it out there.
Yes.
Have you found now that people who used to think that the only option was legal, that you're now going, have you considered mediation?
And they're saying yes, absolutely. Because it works as well. Yeah. You know, you think it sounds, like I say, a bit airy-fairy, but actually it really does work.
Well, you know your success rate, so, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we've got 100% success rate. So, you know, it's
well, let's, really?
Wow.
Let's
That's
talk
amazing.
About
we do.
Good Lord, Vicky.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about the skills of the mediator then, because, you know, I guess if I was in a room sitting opposite someone that I hadn't, you know, that I was in argument with, you know, whether it be commercial or private, doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I guess for me, the key would be in you being able to persuade me that I need to give a little and that they need to give a little in order that we can come to some middle ground. So how do you go about doing that? I mean, what's the training or what's the process behind that? Well, I mean, you've got a lovely smile. So, I mean, you know, if I was in a room with you, I'd sign everything away.
Yeah, that will do it.
Immediately. But
it's what kind of person you are. You know, I mean, I used to be... I'm relatively new to the business sector. I used to be a special needs teacher and a carer, so I'm very much used to working with people and sort of using all the tools in the box to try and get them around to my way of thinking. But it's about just making sure that people feel safe in the space. You don't have to have everyone in a room together. You know, you can say we've got two separate rooms. You don't even have to see this horrible person. Mm-hmm. I will go between you and you write down on a piece of paper saying, this is how I think, this is what I want. And the other person says, this is what I want. And then you say, let's try and meet in the middle, which is actually what lawyers generally do.
So is that a bit like the election at the moment?
Oh, where, God, you keep going back to Brexit.
You know, where the Conservatives want to get Brexit done and Farage doesn't want to get in the way. So he said, I tell you what, I won't contest those seats, but I want this in return. Is it? It's that kind of go-between.
And then when the Lib Dems win and they stop Brexit altogether. So the previous 4 years been a complete waste of time.
We had to get the election in.
I think the government would benefit from a healthy dose of mediation.
Yeah.
Or get in a room and say, this is what's going to happen if you guys don't agree.
Mediate with the public, you mean? Because that's kind of what needs to happen,
or even just each other. They won't talk to each other sensibly, will they?
Give it a go, I think.
No, but seriously, how would you describe the skill set? I mean, empathy, listening, it's, two ears, one mouth.
All of the above, but also being strong enough to say to people who are very much set in their ways when they walk in the room, they are, you know, if they've gone to the point of actually getting a solicitor involved and they've got a legal case running, they are entrenched in their position. And it's being firm enough to say, I've heard what you've said, this is what the other side has said, and this is what, you know, this is where we're at. So how can you move on it? And it's asking the right questions. Mm. You're not allowed to sit there and say, this is what I suggest. Yes. This looks like a good deal for everybody. Mm-hmm. You've got to get people to come to it themselves, because if they come to it themselves, they'll believe in it and they'll believe that they've both done a deal and they'll both walk away happy.
Mm. So you ask the right questions and you ask sort of leading questions.
Not even leading questions. Mm-hmm. You just say, you know.
But what would you say if so-and-so suggested
Well, not even that. You just say, where would you go with this? Where can you move from this? Mm-hmm. What's your position? Mm-hmm. What's the next stage for you to try and move from this? And hopefully they'll say, oh, well, maybe I could, I don't know, put the wheelie bin on my side of the driveway.
That can't be easy, can it? Because people aren't generally speaking, people aren't very creative, are they, with their thought processes? So
they're not. And they also don't like to back down. So it's not easy being a mediator. No. That's what I'm saying. You know, people think it's airy-fairy, everyone sits around with incense and everything. And actually, it's very hard work. It's really, really hard work.
I bet. Like pulling teeth sometimes.
Yeah.
So do you just sit there in sort of silence and sort of pass the fruit bowl round or...
or pass the wooden spoon around and say it's your turn to
talk. Are there those kind of awkward kind of, you know, instances where you just can't seem to get over a sort of a hurdle or...?
I have... I've never seen a mediation that hasn't resolved, except for once when the client walked away. They just got up and left the room. And it wasn't one of our mediations. It was one I was observing, I hasten to add. But if people have come to a mediation, even by coming to the meeting, it kind of shows they've got a level. Yeah, there's a level of wanting to get stuff sorted out. So, you know, it can only be a good thing. And if they're there, you've got something to work with. If someone won't turn up, then you're flogging the devil.
Okay. Now, I must ask you about money. Because
I don't have any.
Oh, well, in that case.
Sorry.
No, but on a serious note, is the remuneration for your mediation services the same as it would be as if you were engaging a solicitor privately? How does that side,
hugely less expensive than engaging a solicitor.
Right.
I mean, quite often, like I say, people will have already engaged a solicitor to fight for them in the legal case, and the solicitor may come to the mediation with them to advise them. But actually, the mediation's not about what the solicitor thinks. You know, as a mediator, I'm not interested particularly in what the barrister or solicitor's saying. I'm interested in what that person wants and how and what they why they went into the sort of disagreement in the first place. And with a mediation, it's a half a day or one day, and you pay an upfront fee, whatever it is, and that's it.
Right. And so it's a fixed fee, half day, full day.
Yeah.
And if you need to do more, it's...
If you need to do more, you pay an hourly rate afterwards. But,
right, okay.
But people are focused on it because they know that come 5 o'clock, the hourly rate kicks in. So they're focused on saying, actually, if we're going to resolve this, by sort of 3 o'clock, you know if they're going
to
resolve it.
10 minutes to resolve this.
Think either we're not doing this. By lunchtime, you'll know whether there's anywhere to go with it. And actually, if people are going on into the afternoon and they're getting somewhere, you're like, actually, you know, we've got a couple more hours. Do you want to start thinking about what a settlement might look like?
Let's get this fixed today.
Let's get it done.
And
people can walk away. And the thing about court is that however strong your case is when you go to court, it depends on the judge that you have on the day, whether they've had an argument with their wife in the morning or, you know, whatever it is. In your case and how, you know, winning or losing can spin on the smallest of factors.
Yeah.
And actually mediation, you get much more of a chance to say what your position is and why you feel like you do.
I like the idea that there's a sort of financial consideration that's putting a time limit on it, you know, in that way, because it makes people have to open up and have a sensible discussion.
Well, it's a great point, because also if you go to court, it could go on forever, couldn't it?
It could go on
for weeks and months.
Like, you know, in a heartbeat, you'll have spent $5,000 on something in court, or even more. And, you know, you won't even have noticed you've done it because you've phoned your solicitor a few times, so you've got a few letters through. Got a barrister involved, and suddenly there's a massive bill at the end of it. You've got actually not very far.
Oh, a mate, I mean, we've all got these stories, but a mate of mine got divorced, and his wife was just sticking on this particular point. So it went to court, and it was over about a £10,000, that might have been £15,000 bit. And it took so long at court, the court fees were over $100,000. For this, and I just thought, is that not illogical? You've just spent $100,000 to argue over 10 or 15.
Who keeps the?
But it's a principle.
The thoroughbred
thing.
Puppy.
That's the point. That you never ever go to court on a matter of principle.
Yeah.
Ever, because it's just not.
It's stupid,
it doesn't
isn't
work.
No.
But it's about being the bigger person and saying,
I think you've talked us all into thinking actually mediation's brilliant. So and you did that quite quick actually as well. So what's your quickest ever mediation session you've ever held?
Oh. Goodness, that's a tricky one. I don't know. When I was doing my the SEND mediations, I did it in about 45 minutes. That was between the local authority and parents, and the parent actually came with a representative, which I was disappointed about because it was I felt like this person was
sort of defeats the object.
Well,
bit, doesn't it?
Taking advantage of the parent's vulnerable position, charging them money when they didn't need to be charged money, and actually the reason it took so long is that the representative sort of had to prove to the parent that he was, you know, she was getting her money's worth.
Right.
But it was literally, you know, they came in and I said, you know, the parent wants you to reassess, and the local authority lady said, "Where's that piece of paper?" And I said, "Here it is." And she said, "Okay," and that was it. So sometimes it is as easy as that, and just getting people in a room where they feel they can say what it is. And sometimes, you know, it's not about money. Sometimes it's about, there's one example where it was really sad. A lady lost her baby, you know, she had a stillbirth because of something that may or may not have happened with the hospital. But it was more about this lady being able to say to the doctors and nurses who were at the birth, "This is how I feel about losing my daughter."
She wanted a voice.
She wanted a voice, and you don't get it. You know, with medical negligence, you may go to court and you might get money for it, but money is not going to bring back the person you've lost.
No.
And actually it's insulting to say,
yeah,
you know, we messed that up. Here's 100 grand. Yeah, yes. Exactly. I find the whole
process. It's strange that, isn't it? Because we had that instant, terrible instance recently where the young lad was knocked off his motorbike in Norfolk or somewhere, and then the lady claimed diplomatic immunity.
Swindon, yeah. The American
Swindon,
lady.
Swindon, was it? Wiltshire. And then they went all the way out to the States, and apparently she was in the room next door at the White House, but they didn't feel that they could meet her. But, you know, you would have thought as a parent, you would... Mm. It'd be so important to have that opportunity to voice, you know, your anger, your... Yeah. Sadness at somebody in that way that was directly responsible. And
exactly. And you're, I mean, you'll never have the opportunity in court. You will never, if you go against, a public body, like, for example, the NHS or whatever, you're never going to have the doctor who was there treating you in the courtroom to say, I'm sorry. You're going to have some faceless person complaint. And actually, it's far more important for people to say, I'm really angry with you because you did X, Y, and Z, and I've now lost whoever it is.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to live with that. And that person turns around and says, I'm really, really sorry, you know. I'm really sorry that happened.
Yes.
And people can then move on with their lives.
You would think so.
So, yeah.
So tell me, half day, how much does it cost?
Oh, it depends on the case, particularly. It's case dependent. I mean, it's like I say, if you're mediating a settlement for, say someone comes in and says, like, we've got £1 million that we just can't decide on, obviously the fee is going to be more than it would be if someone was coming and saying, we can't agree on where the wheelie bin should
go. So it's a neighbourly dispute.
Relative.
Yeah. But like when I say it's a fixed fee as in it, you know what you're paying for that half a day or for that one day.
So give me a guideline for a neighbourly dispute like wheelie bins or party wall or whatever it is.
You know, I mean, you choose. If you say we need an hour's worth of mediation, you might pay, you know, £100 per party. You might pay £200 per party. Right, it depends what it's worth to people and where, and also where the people are coming from. So if you've got two people who are not, who haven't got much money at all, you know, we'll do it. We might do it for voluntary, for pro bono, because it's important to sort it out. Mm-hmm. The work that I do for the between care homes and families, and people who are vulnerable, absolutely do it, you know, as cheaply or as freely as I possibly can, because it's far more important to me that I know someone is going home to a, you know, a residential home where they're cared for and happy, and than me getting £100 or £200 or £500, whatever it is, you know.
And within your group, within your kind of collaboration that you've set up with all these wonderful law firms, are you all signed up to the same charter in terms of what those fees look like and how you determine what they are, or does each firm determine its own fee?
It's on a case by case basis because I mean some people have certain expertise in various areas. Mm. Some people will charge more for various things, and you know we've got some mediators on our books. You know, we've got a guy called Henry Brown who is. He's been doing mediation since the 70s. Mm. You know, he's in his 80s now, and he's sort of the godfather of mediation.
Yeah.
So there's no way that I would expect Henry to charge the same as someone who'd been doing it for 6 months. You know, but people. The point about our company is we've got an online platform where people can go and they can choose their mediator.
That's what I want. That was my next question. So how does somebody come in? They come into your
onto our website. Yeah, so it's called Mediate Kent.
Right.
And on there we'll say it says about us and it's our mediators. And then you'll see there's me and John and Gareth on there and Henry's on there and there's various other mediators on that website. And it has a little blurb about everybody underneath it, how long they've been mediating for, what their background is. You know, they may not have been mediating for very long, but if you've got somebody who's been, I don't know, a teacher for 30 years, you know, that experience is worth its weight in gold when you're mediating an education problem. You know, you might have a doctor who's been, I mean, like, for example, my dad's talking about becoming a mediator, and he's never mediated anything, but he's a consultant nephrologist. He's got 50 years worth of kidney doctor law behind him, you know, and everything like that. So
he knows how hospitals work,
everything, how all that, and you know, that kind of expertise is really, really, really valuable.
So would that be, so I wouldn't just plug in some variables, it would be down to me to have a look at the mediators and in the first instance say, I'd like to work with this person, and then their contact details are there. And
absolutely. And then you type in, fill in the contact form, or give us a ring and say, I like the look of this person.
Yes.
What can they do? And that's it. It's also the people coming to mediation are taking control over their own destinies. You know, they're saying, this is who we want to do it.
Yeah.
We've checked them out. We're not just getting some random judge in court on that day to decide our fates.
Yeah.
And if, the other thing to know is that if mediation doesn't work, you still have the option of going to court.
Of course.
You know, you just crack on and do whatever you're going to do. You're in no worse a position than you were before the mediation. Mm. Mm. And in fact, you may well understand more about the other side than you did before.
Marvellous. So we need to kind of wrap it up there, unfortunately, because we could talk all day about this. So give us a shout out for the website. So the actual, you don't have a website. Sorry,
no, we do have a website. I'm just wondering what the shout out needs to be.
Okay. Well, how do we come in? How do we come in on the portal, and where is it? How do we find you?
So it's www.mediatekent.com.
Mediatekent.com. Yeah. So that's nice.
Yeah, we're simple. On Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook.
Perfect. Yes. Perfect. And SNS, based in Maidstone.
Yep.
Denham House?
Denning House. Denning House, One London
On the
Road.
Hill, at SNS _ law, I think, on
that's
the Twitter.
Right. Yeah, we're on Twitter. That's on Instagram as well, and Facebook and Google
Fabulous.
Ads. And everything.
Good. Vicky, thank you so much for coming in. That has been really enlightening.
Have you got any cases you want to meet?
Well, you know, often, but...
often? Well, between you and Brian?
Yeah. But none at the moment. But no, I will certainly know where to come if I do. And actually, it's a great thing to be able to signpost people to as well, isn't it? And say, look, you know, I've got this problem. You know, I need to get a solicitor. It's like, why do you need to get a solicitor involved? Can't you just have a sensible discussion? Yeah. And I mean, that can be facilitated.
It can be a really proactive thing. It's like a lot of cases I deal with as a solicitor, it's contentious probate, so people arguing about what's going to happen after someone's died.
Yeah.
And actually, if you can get family members in a room for a mediation before this person dies and say, these are the problems and this is what I'm worried about. Mm. Can we sort this out? It would save so much money afterwards.
Yes.
You know. Anyway.
Brilliant.
I'll let you crack on, Martin.
Thank you. Thank you, Vicky. Superb. Well, for now, thank you, Vicky, for coming on the show. I think what we'll do, Brian, is we'll play a bit more music by way of an introduction to our next guest, and we will see you on the other side of this.
It's a kind of magic. It's a kind of magic. A kind of magic. One dream, one soul, one prize, one goal, one golden glance of what should be. It's a kind of magic. One shaft of light that shows the way. No mortal man can win this day. It's a kind. Inside your
Magic.
Well, welcome back, everybody. That was Queen. It's a Kind of Magic. Brian.
Oh, you knew. You didn't even have to ask me. That's a first. Well done. It was indeed Queen. It's a Kind of Magic. And is there a link there, I hear you ask? And,
well, there must be.
I believe there is. There must be. So, wouldn't you say that going to the theatre is a magical experience?
Especially at Christmas.
Especially at Christmas.
A truly magical experience.
It is a kind of magic. So,
on that note, welcome, Paul Turner.
Nice link.
Finance director for the Marlow Theatre in Canterbury.
Right, thanks for having me on.
Paul, great to have you. I know it's an incredibly... Well, we're leading up to probably your busiest time of the year at the moment, aren't we?
Yeah, we should be having around about 90,000 people through our doors in just over 5.5 weeks. So it's great. It's Kent's biggest pantomime and best pantomime, as we always say.
Yeah.
And this year we've got Mother Goose, which is going to be amazing. Yeah. And it's our dame this year, Ben Waddy, the wonderful Ben Waddy. It's his 10th year, so that's the reason why we've decided to do Mother Goose this year, because the dame is the centre of the whole piece. Not that he's not the centre of most pantomimes, to be totally honest, but this year the story is all focused on his role, or her role, we should say.
Yes.
There's nothing like a dame. Or
Ben,
is that a different film?
Brian, you're leading us astray. But Ben is incredibly talented, isn't he? He's a real asset.
He's great, and people know him from pantomime in Kent. But,
yes.
He did a season with the RSC this year as well. You know, he's a great actor as well. So he's done lots of stuff, not just being a pantomime dame, but he's great. But we've got a great cast this year. So we've got Dr. Range, which I think everybody knows, off of CBeebies
Was he on Strictly last year?
And Jenna Russell, who's a leading West End performer and has actually just been casted in Hello Dolly, I think, next year as well, with Imelda Staunton. So it's going to be a great cast.
Big names. Lots of stamina required for the panto.
Well, they do 83 performances.
Wow.
And on a Saturday, they do 3 shows. So they're on that stage on a Saturday for around about 7.5 hours. Yeah. That is tough work.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to the panto, I'm sure, in a little bit. But let's kind of backtrack a few years, if we can. Because I think the Marlow in its current guise was reopened in, was it 2011?
Yeah, 2011 we reopened on October the 4th. Sticks with me very well, that date. And so the old theatre closed in 2009. Mm-hmm. And then reopened in 2011, and we was incredibly lucky to have a city council that was visionary, in honesty, in the importance of culture in Kent, and especially in Canterbury. Mm. So the chief exec and the leaders all took the plunge of the local authority to invest, £26 million back into the centre. At the time as well, I do remember it really, really well, when the decision was made, was virtually the same week that the Icelandic banks collapsed. So to make that decision in that week was very brave, and they did it because they had a vision for Canterbury. And of course, they could have put that theatre anywhere. They could have put it out out on the Windcheap Industrial Estate or anywhere else in Canterbury, but they made the real bold decision to keep it in the centre of Canterbury. And that's been brilliant for businesses in Canterbury to have that footfall come into the centre and come and watch these great shows. But the big important thing was them 1,200 seats, so we get the biggest, best shows ever in Canterbury.
So what was it before? What was the capacity before?
So it was just around about 900.
Oh, okay.
So now we do 1,200. But I mean, that is a big difference between the top shows and the small shows. So the shows that you've all seen in Canterbury, War Horse and Mamma Mia, them top shows would not be in the old Marlow Theatre. That would never happen. And Les Mis, which we've announced, which is coming next year in October, that was a huge amount of work from the team to even secure that. And 1,200 seats, we are on the cusp of just getting them type of shows.
Really? So it's not the access necessarily with all the infrastructure that comes with a show like that.
It's bums on seats.
Bums on seats, that's what they're interested in.
Yeah, it's not like cinema where you go and watch cinema where all the work's been done elsewhere and a memory stick's plugged in and everybody sits back and watches the film. Mm-hmm. In theatre, there's shows that come in, there's a cast of maybe 60 people that's got to live in Canterbury for 4 weeks or 5 weeks for Les Mis, for example. It'll be 10 or 12 Arctic lorries that are coming into Canterbury to set up the show. So the running costs for it are constant, whereas the running costs for a film, once it's made, is done. So it's...
A team, you have to go out and court these big shows. You have to kind of say, look, we want you at the Marlow.
We've got a new chief exec, which is Deborah Shaw, who is absolutely driven by making sure that we have the best on our stage.
Right.
And that does mean on some occasions people don't just knock on your door and say, just take this wonderful show. Sometimes you have to go knocking on their door going, come on, bring it together. And that's how we got Les Mis. We didn't get Les Mis by just sitting back and hoping the phone was going to ring. We got there. We got that by being persistent and keep knocking on that door and getting that show to come to Canterbury, and which we're incredibly proud of. And we're about 65% sold. It's not here till next October.
Yeah. I love Les Mis. I love the film, actually, with Hugh Jackman and... yeah, I think it's a great film. It's a great story, isn't it? So, fantastic. Good. So 2011, you reopened. You've got more capacity. You can attract bigger shows, more bums on seats, more revenue. But you're still very much under the ownership, for want of a better word, of the council.
Yeah, we was owned and managed by the City Council right up until December last year. And fantastic support with an ambition to make the theatre self-sufficient. And because not many theatres in the UK that are certainly... that are owned by local authorities or actually privately owned as well, actually run at a profit. That's not the situation whatsoever. And so that our aim was to make ourselves profitable, which we managed to do with inside council management. And once we got to that position, there was a will and a power to look at us being let loose effectively as an independent charitable trust, which was, as you know, because you've been at the theatre a lot, that was basically 3 years of my life was working on that with Paula Gillespie, one of my colleagues, working on that. And then eventually we did go in December last year. So it's been great. We've now able to do lots of stuff that, whilst we wanted to do it within the local authority, it's very difficult to do it inside the local authority. So actually raising money, being a charity, is great to have that opportunity to apply for funding to really impact on people's lives in Kent as well. So we work a huge amount with schools and local communities, and there's funding there available for that. And it's very difficult when we're a local authority-run theatre for an authority to go asking for money when... they're saying, well, actually, your local authority, just fund it yourself. Yes. So it's opened up lots of opportunities for us. So we do engage in our own activity every week for 250 young people and some older people as well in our classes. But we engage weekly with 40 schools across Kent, taking the RSC into the schools and giving them the opportunity to perform and learn about the performing arts as well. So it's really important part of our work that we do. So we've got two members of the team that are engaged completely in our community. That's what they're to do. And all our marketing as well, about engaging in them areas where, you know, people are not coming to watch theatre, and we want to understand why they're not coming to theatre, because that's our next generation. It's great being where we are at the moment with lots of disposable income for that generation of people, that baby boom generation who would like to spend their money. But where's the next generation coming from? So that's what we're really working hard on, to make sure that we have another audience.
And that's why that outreach programme with schools is so important, because they're the next generation.
We had a great concert on Saturday night where we have a resident orchestra called Philharmonia, and classical music is really, really tough for us to sell, with an ageing population of watching that actually not able to come to theatre anymore. Where's that next audience going to come from? And if we can't get an audience for it, how are we going to put that on our stage? And so we work really hard with Philharmonia to make sure that we do accessible performances. So actually at the weekend was a 90-piece orchestra with the conductor Cole Davis on stage as well, who's 83 now, and they did the music of James Bond with a big band orchestra. Absolutely amazing. And then we've done stuff
John Barry
stuff, and even up to the latest stuff with like Adele on Skyfall and stuff like that. And so we do that. And we work really hard with them to make sure that we're engaging with young people. So in February, I can't remember the exact date, but in February there's another concert which we've got on a Sunday. And in the afternoon we've got an accessible concert for families, which is a lot more targeted at young people and families to come and never tried it and make it affordable. And the theme of that will be classical music. But actually people don't realise, for example, that Gustav Holst's The Planets is basically that's Star Wars, you know, and actually engaging people going, this is what you listen to. And Philharmonia, our resident orchestra, actually do all the Marvel comic films. They're the orchestra that record all of that. So to have that relationship with them is brilliant. So we work really hard. But the classical pieces of work that are out there, that and the dance and also plays, we really have to fight to get an audience. And that's what we're working really hard on, because we want to be that theatre for everybody. So, you know, I always say about, I remember our first ever brochure that came out was we had Glyndebourne on one side, the UK's finest opera company, arguably, maybe even Europe's finest opera company, coming to Canterbury. On the page next to it was Peppa Pig. Yeah. And that's because we have lots of audiences. We don't have one audience. And that's how we keep the numbers up.
Glyndebourne is an interesting case study, isn't it? Because that's Glyndebourne on tour.
Yeah, yeah. Five venues they do in the UK.
But you also go on tour. The Marlow go on tour as well, don't you? Because you run productions in, I think you did one around Remembrance Sunday. Was it last
year?
We've now got
a whole production arm for the organisation, really, and that's our ambitions for the future, is to move into producing. So we have made some work and shown it. So last year we did Return of the Unknown, and we did it in the old railway station in the Dover cruise terminal, basically it is now. And
so that would have been the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was
So it was all based around that.
About.
It was all based around that, and this is where our community outreach works because our youth theatre were engaged as well, but actually local schools were as well, and in total across the whole week, because there's different groups dropping in and out, and every day over 950 people in Kent performed that week.
Amazing.
And over 2,500 people watched it as well, so you know the participation number was close to what was actually watching it as well, which is amazing. So,
and Ben was your leading...
Yeah, Ben Roddy, our pantomime dame, was...
He's very versatile, isn't he?
Yeah, no, he's great,
Yeah, superb. So,
and that's definitely the areas that we're looking at, because Canterbury's got a great following of watching theatre, there's no doubt about that, but actually the universities are educating people in making theatre. And whilst we put on theatre, other people's productions, is there an opportunity for them to develop their skills in making theatre? And that's our next step to actually, that's part of the ecology as well, isn't it? And how we can invest more in Canterbury, and the economics of it all works, because that's more jobs, that's people living in Canterbury, and that's our next phase. So watch this space on that, because we'll be announcing some stuff really soon about the type of work that we're going to be making, possibly co-producing, and in the long term, made in Canterbury, hopefully. Yeah.
Well, one of my questions for you today was going to be, you know, where do you go from here, because you're such a huge success story already, but you've just described it, really. It's a never ending.
Well, when we was leaving the council, I do remember sitting in the council office speaking to some colleagues up there and going, well, you've done it now, that's it, you're out, you're free, and that's it. And I mean, some people would sit back and go, yeah, let's just do what we want to do, but you know, the vision was always, you know, look at what other theatres across the UK do that are independent. So there's theatres like Chichester Festival Theatre, which have made work and took it into the West End, and it's part of their sustainability, where they've made great work. You know, we talked about Imelda Staunton briefly earlier on, but you know, that was a Chichester Festival Theatre production, which they made Gypsy, and it dropped into the West End and did brilliantly. And there's other theatres like Plymouth, which are, you know, they are setting up shows like The Lion King in Plymouth. And then taking it into the West End or taking it on the national tour. Well, come on, we're Canterbury. Why can't we do that in Canterbury and make that happen in Kent?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the real future for us, really.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, every year that evolves. And, I mean, new opportunities come along, and it is a continually evolving kind of...
What we have got behind the back of it is a great asset and a sustainable business with brilliant audiences. And if we didn't have them brilliant audiences, we wouldn't be able to do this new exciting stuff and take the community with us on that journey as well, and our audience with us as well. Because what we really want, of course, is get our audiences to try new stuff as well. It's not all about the massive musicals that are coming. Absolutely love them, you know, they're brilliant, but you know, try some new stuff as well.
Yeah.
And it allows us to take a bit of risk, so look for a bit of risk taking in our programming now and again as well. We certainly did it this year. We had a great piece of Rita Sue and Bob Two, which is, you know,
film.
So you think of the film, and what actually was that film really touching on? Well, that was basically a teacher grooming kids, you know, and we put a play of that on our main theatre stage. That wasn't a studio piece where we normally really challenge our audience. That was in the theatre on the main stage, and I think they loved it. Audience numbers weren't amazing, but we had an audience for it, and it worked. So
I want to talk, if we can, now about your business membership, because all of this footfall, all of these punters coming through the door on a kind of daily basis represent a massive opportunity for businesses to talk to potential customers. So you have a very active business membership
club.
We do.
So we've got a whole team that work on this, really. And the main driver behind it is Matt Clark, which you know Matt well. And so he looks after all our businesses. So
cocktail maker extraordinaire.
Yeah, he's great. I love it when he does his samples in the office. Yes. Yeah.
He dreads it when I turn up to one of his cocktail evenings. It means it's going to be a busy night for him.
So Matt looks after all of our businesses and our networking events and gives our businesses the opportunity. So we do a business membership scheme. So it's a bit like a friend scheme, but for businesses. Mm-hmm. And it's the opportunity for the businesses to be known to our theatre audiences. So they're within our programmes, they're within our brochures, they're on our digital screens. Yeah. And then there's special things that then businesses can get the opportunity to do. So you can come to opening nights of shows, you can get your discounts as well. And that's not just for the owners as the businesses, it's for the staff as well. So you want to treat your staff. This is a real good way in tough times to actually give your staff a bit of a perk as well.
Yeah.
And so
it's a really nice benefit to offer staff,
it's a
isn't it?
As well, isn't it?
Yes.
I think it'd be really well received.
Yeah. So, and Matt did tell me that you'd ask this question today. And anybody that's a Supply My Business member can get £50 discount as well, he says to me.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
So that's great. So, 25 staff, up to 25 staff would be £400 a year for small businesses with the £50 discount. And more than 25 is £950. And then Matt runs loads of networking events as well during the year. So, we have around about six a year where Matt's getting you in, and this year we've got one on the 13th of December, which is all based around the pantomime as well. So
that's a lunch, and you'll be able to meet the cast.
Yeah, lunch, meet the cast, and it's free to business members.
Yes,
and then if anybody else wants to come, they can actually buy the ticket and opportunity to come. But it's
about
a great networking.
£18 or something normally,
something
isn't
like
it?
That,
very
yeah.
reasonable. So yeah, and great networking. Yeah,
I mean, on 60 people will be at them, 60 different businesses normally at our big networking events.
Yeah.
And we are lucky, we do theme them around a certain subject every time. So we've done Warhorse and we've done Mamma Mia and stuff like that. But they are great, and definitely invite members to come along and see what's going on.
Well, I'm very lucky to be invited to the launch, the press night launch for the Panto, which I think is next Tuesday, courtesy of Jackie at J&J Systems, who I think are business club members as well.
Yeah.
And that's a fabulous night. I mean, that is something that you really just wouldn't want to miss. And Vicky, we were talking about the fact that you're not a seasoned pantomime goer yet.
No, I've only been to one, but I'm definitely looking forward to
it. But it really is quite addictive. And you know, I think the power in that, in terms of, you know, how businesses leverage their membership on a kind of, on all sorts of different levels, but certainly in terms of staff engagement and kind of getting people excited on that level.
And £400,000 people a year coming through our doors.
Yeah.
You know, it's a busy place. And
what I love about the business development team, which I think, is it Sam that heads up?
Yeah, Sam heads it up,
up that team, is that you guys, you know, it's a blank sheet of paper. If somebody comes to you and says, do you know what, I really, you know, I'm going to come on board as a business member, but I want to do this, or I'd like to do that, or could I sponsor an evening where we did this, you know, you guys are always open to, well, you're a theatre, so you're incredibly
creative. Lots of our business members have engaged to start with by being a member and then got on to sponsor things and do other stuff as well with us. So lots of them.
And everybody raves about it. Bruce at Oasis is another member. So, it's fabulous. It's a lovely thing to be a part of.
And when
so.
You've got that many businesses that engage with you as well, I mean, the opportunities are there for people just to engage and, you know, get more business at the end of the day. That's what we're all there for. We have great fun at them, but, you know, the team will be there. I always tend the business networking ones as well, generally. And that's about us actually making sure that you're all engaging with each other to, you know, to grow your business, because we really do care about that.
Yeah. Just quickly, how many staff do you actually employ at the theatre now? What's your headcount looking like?
So it's around about 174. Obviously, that's moving all the time. And there's a core team of around about 96 now, which are full-time, and the rest of them are part-time.
Wow.
So, so it's a big organisation. You know, we're not a small theatre, and we have to keep making sure that we've got our fingers on the pulses. So,
and that younger generation, as you say, is key. I mean, I'm a member of a golf club that has an ageing membership.
Yeah.
In the same way that your theatre has an ageing audience. And, you know, you've really got to nurture the youngsters coming through the system, as it were.
Well, we do that. We do that as well through our traineeship as well. So we do a trainee and we've just recruited 3 new trainees. And we deliberately don't do these apprenticeship levy type things, no. And where they get paid low wages or anything like that. We pay the cost of living wage. Mm-hmm. So it's free posts, which comes out of our budget. We're not funded in any way to do this. So, and we had over 100 applicants for free jobs to mm-hmm. come and work for the theatre. Mm-hmm. And a young guy that's actually coming to join our team on the traineeship originally was at our youth theatre via a funded mechanism with a donor that paid for that individual to go to youth theatre, gone through all our youth theatre, gone off and done his degree, finished his degree, and he's now coming back to work for us. And what a great story that is. And that's about our engagement at the very beginning, because we hadn't engaged with him to start with. That's where it was. And he's a refugee, and what a wonderful story that he's been given that opportunity and settled in England. And, you know, that's our outreach really working.
Yeah, yeah. And it's lovely to have huge, you know, business success stories like you that are able to retain talent locally in the local area, because so many people just, you know, I mean, I did it. I got on a train and I went to work in London. But isn't it nice for young people to see opportunities on their doorstep to actually, you know, train and have a career locally rather than feel the need to fly the nest and, you know.
Yeah, we have a lot. We have lots of people that you're obviously at university at the moment who are working on our bars and ushering in the evening, and they're all brilliant part of the team. Yeah. And so many of them, once they have finished, say, actually, I want to stay in Canterbury and look for their other roles. So he was talking earlier on about you know, our chief exec who's there now, Deborah. Some of her team were originally ushers.
Yes.
And now they're programming and contracting these massive shows and working in that areas. And actually, Matt, who we talked about earlier, who's our business, he looks after our businesses. Matt originally worked for us whilst he was at university and was an usher, and then served coffee and then went off to work for a bank, didn't like it, and come back. And now he's doing all our business networking events. Yeah. He's great. So, once they're in, they don't want to go.
So you really are a community asset that sits very much at the heart of the of everything that's going on in the city, right in the centre of the city.
I'd like to think that in the centre of Kent, I think people definitely love the Marlowe, not just people in Canterbury love the Marlowe, but I think everybody in Kent really does love the Marlowe. Yeah. And we work really hard to make sure that they do as well. And it is difficult because, you know, these moments in time is where people can literally press a button on their TV and watch whatever they like from anywhere in the world, including theatre, remember
just
now.
Stream it, yeah.
Just stream it now. You can stream theatre or cinemas are putting theatre on as well. But there's nothing like that sitting there and watching that live performance and go, oh my God, that person is amazing.
Yeah.
Whether that be a comedian or whether that be a great singer or whether that be a great actor.
Well, I love the comedy nights. The comedy nights are hilarious. I mean, you've got one coming up, I think, on the 18th.
Yeah, on the 18th,
Just before Christmas.
Yeah. So it's live at the Marlowe, and it's around £20 a ticket. Mm-hmm. You get 4 comedy acts. There'll be a compare. It's great, and there'll be people that you've heard of, people that you've not heard of, but it's a brilliant night. It's in the theatre, not in the studio. We do another alternative comedy night in the studio, which I encourage everybody to go and have a look at as well. If you like quirky, you'll like that.
Yeah. Superb. Good. Well, Paul, I think for now, again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You, we haven't actually said when is the panto on.
Well, I did say it starts.
Should we take a rough guess?
I did say the press launch was next Tuesday, but it actually starts this week.
It starts on Thursday this week
night.
And runs right through to the 12th of January.
Yeah.
Thursday this week?
Yeah.
So that's the 28th
of
November.
Oh, the world's gone mad, isn't it?
And I'm assuming you've got all your decorations up and everything
else. Do you know what? I grabbed myself a coffee before I got in the car to come over here, went into the foyer, and there they were, decorating the front of the building.
So you've got a fabulous website. All the shows are on there.
Yep.
You've also got a business membership kind of section on the website as well.
Yep, so it's all on the website. All on the networking,
all of that is all on there. Superb. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, if you are going to the Panto this year, everybody do book early because it is always oversubscribed, I think it's fair to say, isn't it?
We're always really busy.
And if you want to go on a particular day, like all Pantos, I think generally at this time of year, you need to book early, I would suggest. That would be our advice there. So superb. Brian, I think we've got about a minute left to close the show. So anything you'd like to talk about before we say goodbye to our listener?
Well, we have a number of events coming up, but we won't have time to go
through
those.
That's why I only give you a minute.
And yeah, exactly. So I can't promote anybody or anything. Right. So that's fantastic. Fine. But no, just worth noting that the next show in 2 weeks' time, on the 9th of December, is actually our final show of the year.
Yeah.
Because 2 weeks after that, 23rd of December, we want to be in a pub, don't we?
Yeah. So,
commitment for you.
Yeah, exactly, Vicky. Yes. Well spotted.
No, well said. So we will be back in 2 weeks' time, but that will be our last show before 2020. Crikey, yeah, this year's flown by, hasn't it?
But we do make an early start back on the 6th of January.
Yes, we do. We'll be back on the 6th. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much, our guests. Vicky from Mediate Kent.
Mm.
Paul from the Marlowe Theatre.
Great, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming along. Brian, as always, thank you to you as well.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, never a chore, Whitey.
And we will be back in 2 weeks' time.